Little Rock, Arkansas. Hello, Eureka Springs.
Hello, Jerry.
I am so glad to be here. When Mike called and said, you know, I said, well, I was just there a few years ago. He said, yeah, but I love you. Oh, well, I've never been able to turn down an alcoholic who loves me. They're my specialty. It was exceptionally pretty driving up here Thursday. J.D. and I had a leisurely drive and just looked like snow all out through the hills, all the dogwoods abloom. It's always a special time for me. And I appreciate very much the committee and Mike for allowing us to come and participate again this year. It's just always a thrill. I love to be. There's nothing I like better than being with a group of alcoholics and Al-Anons, I'm telling you. You know, we're the people that know how to have fun. Now, when I came into Al-Anon many years ago, I wasn't real happy there. I wanted to be an alcoholic. Well, there was laughter in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the Al-Anon room was those little thin-lipped cookie-baking bitches, you know? I related to the alcoholic story better, too. I just didn't have an allergy to alcohol. So with that, I'm going to tell you, my name is Mary Pearl, and I'm an Al-Anon who is a big book, black belt Al-Anon from the Rose City Family Groups, and I am happy, joyous, and free. Poor little old Charlie. Where is Charlie? I scared him. I guess so. You know, we've had a big book study at our group, the Al-Anon group, for over 10 years now. We might teach him something. Anyway. I love to play with Charlie. With Barbara's permission. No, it's been an amazing thing to me over the years, the things how my life has changed. You know, the person you see here is not the person who came in January 1977. Not the same person at all. And I probably wouldn't have been the same person anyway, but this way it's much better. You know, first of all, I'm alive today, which I probably wouldn't have been the way I did stuff. And I'm not in prison today, which I probably would have been the way I did stuff, because every once in a while it gets a little iffy on that. And I had this uncontrollable temper. I had a lot of resentments. I had a lot of rage. I get tickled. I was watching Judge Judy yesterday afternoon. They were talking about road rage, and I thought, these are wimps. Three little boys fighting. They hadn't lived, you know. I remember one time a girl cut me off, and then we got stuck in a line of traffic. I got out, went up, and beat on her window. And she locked her door. I said, you needn't do that. If I want in there, that won't stop me. I had her begging forgiveness on the I-30. And that's before I was carrying a gun. J.D. told me, he said, you pull that crap today, you'll get killed. I said, I can give back, you know. I can give back. No, it's not near as much fun as it used to be to do that madness stuff. But I found a lot of excitement. You see, my drug of choice is adrenaline. I love excitement. If I don't have some, I create some. It's just that simple. And that was one of the things that was going to get me in a lot of trouble. That need for excitement in my life. That need for attention in my life. I'm the youngest of four children, and I'm a change-of-life baby, and I was an Army brat, and I was spoiled rotten by my daddy. Absolutely. I loved it. If I'd still been spoiled rotten, you would have a different speaker today. If I could have had my way, what I wanted, when I wanted it, there would be no need for me to ever change, do anything any differently. But that wasn't going to be the case. And I'm going to share, you know, Daddy was a retired Army officer of 38 years, and we went hunting and fishing all the time together. And Mother stayed at home. My mother was the kind of person that if you weren't working and doing something productive, you weren't worth anything. Praise God I didn't get her at work ethic. But anyway, saved from that. My sister had that. But anyway, I would go fishing with Mom and with Daddy, and this one day Mama decided to ruin it, and she came with us. And what she did that day, I caught a little bitty fish, and the first thing she did was she took a look at it, said, "It's not a keeper," ripped it off my hook and threw it back. Well, I went into a screaming coma right there in the boat. And my daddy said, "Honey, come back to the back end of the boat with me." And as I got close to Daddy, he said, "And we'll get her." Now, I didn't know what it meant, but intuitively I knew I was going to like it. And what it meant was that every fish the old heifer caught that day, she would swing around, he would take it off, rebait her hook, she'd swing back around, he'd hand me the fish, and I'd throw it over. Every fish the old girl caught. Now, Daddy was playing a joke on Mama, but that's not what I heard. What I heard was, anytime anybody does anything that hurts you, do it back to them as many times as you can. Now, I know today that's revenge, but when I was doing a four-step, that was my most pleasant childhood memory. My mother was the disciplinarian in the home. She was the one that had all the rules and regulations, and it was, she was a controller, is what it amounts to, I know today. And you see, my mother had been damaged by the disease of alcoholism. Her mother, her father, two brothers, and two sisters were alcoholic. My mother didn't drink. I think she needed one. She might have been a happier camper. But anyway, because I hear y'all say you take a drink, you get relief, you feel better. She never felt good. Never felt good. She was always mad. When I was 12 years old, I watched my father die of a heart attack on the 30th of November. And it just, my world ended as I knew it, because he was my protector. He was my best friend. He was my buddy. I felt loved. I felt, and all that was taken away. I no longer felt good. I no longer felt good. And not only that, I had been taken to church, and I believed that God loves you and that you'd sing the little songs, "Jesus loves me," and then all of a sudden I know that's not true, because if Jesus loved me, he would not have taken away my daddy. So I turned away from any kind of spiritual belief, value system, or anything at the age of 12. Now, I didn't know it at the time. This is all retrospect, and this is my story, you know. This is what I have learned since I've come to you. I've learned a lot of things about me that I never knew, and I know why I do the things I do. It doesn't always stop me from doing, because as we know, self-knowledge alone avails you not much, you know. And half measures avail you nothing. So there we are. But anyway, I went on and I declared war on my mother. I was really mad at God for letting her live, and it was her fault. And so I took it out on her. Now, I know today if I'd had a kid like me, I'd killed it. Very simple, very simple. There was a lot of physical abuse in our home. There was a lot of verbal abuse in our home because Mother and I had declared war on one another, and whoever dies, the other one wins. And that's the way it was growing up. And but the one place I found that I could achieve was in school. My school teachers loved me. You know, I'm the straight-A student. I'm the one that does all the stuff. I follow the rules. I do the stuff. I know where to get my perks. And that's what I did. I got that through my schooling. And I would have still been in school today, you know, if they hadn't. That's enough. Send her away. Send her away. We've had all, you know, I was also the only kid on the national. I had more days in detention hall than anyone in the history of the National Honor Society at our school. I had this little discipline problem, you know. I mean, I was smart, but I didn't have a lick of common sense. And I thought I could do everything and get away with stuff, and the rules didn't apply to me. You know, that's like, you know, you can find out real easy if you're one of those kind of people. Do you follow the speed limit? See, none of you do. That's the reason we're here. You know, if it's at 60, you got to go 62, for God's sake. You know, you have to just push it, you know, just push the edge a little. And that's the way I would do always. I would just push up to the edge and then, step over. You know, it's exciting out there over the edge. And when I was 16, I went to jail the first time. And the first time. Don't you like that? See, I'm a low bottom out now. That's the reason they love me. You know. And it could have been, I could have had a ticket for speeding, but instead I got speeding, resisting arrest, assaulting an officer of the law, hitting an officer of the law, actually kicking him. And they took me to jail. So that was when I was 16. You know, I'm off to a good start. Later on, I would get there, still into the violence, obviously. But anyway, in the 50s, they built the Little Rock Air Force Base. And I was so thrilled because, you know, it was getting pretty dull at home and nothing going on. I read in the paper where there was 10 men for every woman in North Little Rock, and I want my 10. So I went out to the base of trolling. And I want your 10 and your 10 too. I mean, you know, is there ever too much of a good thing? You know, I'm like the alcoholic walks in a bar, sees a sign, all you can drink for a dollar, and he said, give me $2 worth. I mean, that's the way I am. Now, if it's worth doing, do it till you die on the spot. So that's what I'm doing. I'm out there, and I met this little old Yankee boy. Now, things were really bad at home, but back when I was growing up, you only left home if you went away to college or if you got married. That was the only two acceptable ways to leave home. You know, if my mother said, I told her, I said, I want out. I want an apartment. She said, you can't. And I said, well, why not? She said, because. She's the only girl that want out now an apartment or won't be doing stuff they ought not to be doing. That may be true, and I did. But I wanted to. Let me out there. And, well, you see, in our home, you couldn't do much. You know, Mama was real conservative about things. And she was firmly convinced that if you wore nail polish, you'd be a whore. And, well, see, if you paint your nails, it's just the first step before you smoke. And if you smoke, you're going to drink. And if you drink, you know you're going to be a whore. So there it is. Anyway, I married this little old boy to get away from home. I know that today, but I was in love with the idea of being love and came in heat about the same time. It all worked pretty good together. And he took me away from home. He took me further than I asked to go. He took me to Newfoundland. Not on my list of places to vacation, much less live, I'm telling you. And we were there for about 5 years. Now, it's a land of, you think it's cold out here. This is nothing. We're talking because I know somebody sitting right over here who was there with me at the same time in Newfoundland, and we had an average snowfall of 290 inches, and we had snow 9 months of the year, you know. It was a real fun place. I can tell you one thing about Newfoundland, boring. And the excitement to be held was in the clubs, because that's where you heard the sound of the ice going in the glass, and you heard the little stuff pouring in, and it was like music to my ears because people were laughing and they were having a good time. And see, that's what I always wanted to do, just be having a good time. And so I would go to those clubs. Now, my husband played in the band in the club, so that left me to troll the room. And I found slot machines and other men. It was wonderful, just wonderful. I found enough excitement there, it ruined my marriage. I got carried away. I like to say that, doing everything till you can die on the spot. And so I worked for the American Red Cross when I was there. I was assistant field director, and I liked it. It was a position of power. Because if you are a military guy on an overseas base, the only way you can get off that base for emergency leave is with Red Cross verification. So it gave you a little bit of power there. And so I had me little things going on, like I had a black market going on the flight line. I got homesick for Arkansas food, and it was in the summertime, and so there was a big KC-97 going down to Maryland, and the guy went on down, and they picked us up a load of watermelons and brought them back, and I was selling watermelons up in Newfoundland for $10 a piece, and this is in 1962. Well, you know, supply and demand, let me tell you, you know. But when our assignment came back, and we were supposed to, after 5 years in Newfoundland, we were supposed to go to Minot, North Dakota. And I said, I'm not going to Minot. And I said, I've been in this cold, snowy stuff all I want. I want to go back where it's going to be wonderful and it's going to be different. I want to go back to Little Rock Air Force Base. And it's funny how you get away and you think everything's going to be different. Well, see, the only problem is wherever you go, there you are, you know. And I didn't know I was going to be taking me back. And the guy said, well, there's not an opening in your husband's career field. Well, a little thing like that's never stopped me. And I said, well, change it. And he said, what do you mean? I said, put him in another career field, one there's an opening in. And he said, oh, hadn't thought about that. And I said, well, do it. So all of a sudden, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, we go to Little Rock Air Force Base, and he's a missile inspector. Never seen one. That ought to make you sleep good tonight. And all it cost me was a case of Chevys. You know, alcohol was a daily part of my life. You know, alcohol on an overseas base was just dirt cheap. Cigarettes were too back then. You'd get them for 90 cents a carton. Yes, Lord. Anyway, so I came back home. We're in Little Rock now again, and everything's going to be wonderful. Guess what? There we were. It wasn't wonderful. And I knew what the problem was. It was him. If I could just get rid of him, then it would be okay. See, I mean, everything, it's all about me being okay. And so I convinced him that what we need to be was separated, because I wasn't ready to be self-supporting through my own contributions. I had done that overseas, and I had this, and I said, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to paint. I'm an artist. I want to paint, and I want to sculpt, and I want to do all this wonderful stuff, and I don't want to live with you while I'm doing it. And so he said, okay, and you see, I took advantage of that boy, because, see, his mom and his daddy left his mama when he was a baby, and his mama died when he was 12, and he was left orphaned with a grandfather who didn't want him. And so it was very important for him to maintain that image of that family unit together. So he would have put up with anything rather than to be divorced. And I took advantage of that. So he went his way, and I was going to live there, and I did what I wanted to do. And the only problem about that is, all my life I did what my mama told me not to do, and I had done what my husband didn't want me to do, and now I can do what I want to do. And you know something? I don't know what to do. You know, that's a strange thing, but if you've never had that freedom, you don't have a clue. And so I got into trouble. And I began to watch. I've always been a people watcher, too, and I began to watch what was going on in my neighborhood, and there was a boy across the street, and I knew he was one of them. Now, by one of them, I'm talking about he was a drunk, because I knew all about drunks. My mama had a whole family of them. My grandfather died in the state hospital with wet brain from alcoholism. My grandmother died of cirrhosis of the liver from alcoholism. My uncle, A.B., was shot in bed with another man's wife. He was my favorite. I had two aunts and an uncle that were still practicing at the time, and so I knew what about alcohol. I knew what they did, and what they did, they went out, they got drunk, they came home, and they fought one another, and they hurt one another. And that's what was going on next door. This boy would go out, and he'd get drunk, come back, and beat up his little wife. And she was French-Canadian and spoke very little English. Well, see, I'd been living in Canada. I could speak. And so I went over there, and Joanne and I became very good friends. And she got pregnant, and the night she went into labor, he came home and beat her up. And she came over to my house, and her nose was bleeding, and her mouth was cut. And she said, will you take me to the hospital? And I said, sure. And I went over with her. And you know how alcoholics will pass out on the bed with that little smirk on their face, like they've done something good? He was so pleased with himself. And I looked at him, and I looked at her, and I thought, you know, somebody ought to whip his butt. And then I had my first spiritual awakening. I'm somebody. So I rolled him up in his bed sheet, I took a slat out of the bed, and I beat the fool out of him. And the next morning, he came over to my house, and he said, do you know where Joanne is? I said, yes. She's at the hospital. She had a baby last night. And he said, well, I was out with some friends, and I got into a fight. I didn't have a clue what a blackout was, but I was grateful today, you know. So anyway, I went on like that, and then I had this other neighbor that lived on the other side of me, and he had a drinking problem, and the doctor told him he was an alcoholic, said, Freeman, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. Well, he quit drinking, died anyway, but he was miserable, let me tell you. He did not find Alcoholics Anonymous, and all he did was he just didn't drink, and he was, I knew what irritable, restless, and discontent meant when I was looking at Freeman. I didn't realize I had it too. You know, that's the thing. You have it, and you don't know you got it. And what it amounted to was I was a night person. I'm still a night person. My clock's just in backwards. That's all I know. And so I would come home around 7 o'clock in the morning from having fun. And Freeman had a garden. He wanted to till his garden at 8 o'clock in the morning. How unreasonable can you be? And so I went out there and told him about it, and he told me to shut my mouth and get my fat butt back in the house. He didn't know about Mama and the fish. So I got my daddy's frog gigging headlight, and I mowed grass at 11:30 at night. Well, the sheriff came to see me. Have you never noticed how law enforcement people are very narrow-minded? The sheriff talked to me about it, and I tried to explain. He didn't understand, so I went into Plan B. Now, Freeman had beagles. He had 6 beagles. Now, if you've got one beagle, you got a barking little dog. Well, he had a whole chorus out there. So I would wait until the wee hours of the morning. I'd run off my back porch, run across the yard, take a broom handle, run up and down that dog yard fence. Come back, jump on my porch. Now, they were going this barking frenzy, and he'd come out, and he'd cut them out, hose them down, go back in the house, and I'd wait an hour, and we'd do it one more time. Well, a sheriff came to see me. And after several more plans, it became obvious the sheriff and I were beginning to develop a relationship. So I had to, and that's when I noticed, okay, direct your energy somewhere else. You got a neighborhood softball team. Well, I'm an athlete. I love sports. So I said, that's it. So I got me some stretch boots and hot pants, and I joined the team. I am here. And so it was our custom after the game to go back over to someone's house, and we'd discuss the strategy of our game, what we should, shouldn't have done, and we would pop a few tops. Some of them would sniff some stuff, and some others were smoking those little funny cigarettes, just your normal neighborhood, you know. And it was their time to be over at my house, and this little boy, he was like 18, but he got drunk at my house. And I got to thinking, you know, that's the most dangerous thing you can ever hear from an Al-Anon. I got to thinking. And when I got to thinking, I thought, you know, if he gets picked up going home and they find out where he got booze, you'll be in big trouble because he's underage. So to cover myself, I decided I'd drive this boy home. Now, it was around Mother's Day, and he had bought a China tea set for his mother for Mother's Day. So get the picture. It's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm going into a strange house carrying a China tea set, escorting a drunken 18-year-old kid. Okay? Never been there before in my life. And he flipped the light on in the bedroom. And when he did, there was a man laying on the bed in his underwear. And he looked up and said, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. And I said, not tonight, fella. But that's who I'm married to, J.D. Perhaps you got yours on the front row of the choir. I didn't. Later on that summer, we started dating, and it was just wonderful. I mean, we could talk to one another about anything, everything. It was the most open, warm, wonderful relationship I'd ever had. However, there comes a point in time when there's a time to tell things, and if you go past that time, there doesn't seem to be a good time that sort of tell it lends itself. And so we had a wonderful courtship, lasted about 4 years, and he ruined it. He asked me to marry him. And that's when it occurred to me I had forgotten to give him some information. And I said, J.D., I can't marry you. And he said, why not? I said, because I'm already married. And he was shocked. Now, see, intuitively I knew if I told him I was married, he would not have dated me. And so that's one of those things, you know, you just don't say. And he said, well, you sure didn't act married. And I said, well, I forgot. What's amazing to me about that is he still wanted to marry me, a woman who has admittedly that she can't remember she's married. So he wasn't wrapped too tight either, you know. Well, I got divorced, we got married, and guess what? Alcoholism moved into my house. I didn't have a clue he had that. I mean, I knew he didn't know how to drink right. I knew that. You know, and it's like without a drink, he was sort of boring. But if he had a couple of drinks, he was exciting. I just didn't have him very long because he never stopped at 2 drinks, you know. It was sort of like having a harem. You know, you'd have the guy that picked you up, the guy that had 2 drinks, and then there was the guy that had about 4 drinks, and he began to feel sorry for himself, and then you had the guy that had about 8 drinks, and then he got a mouth on him like an old chevy trunk lid, wouldn't cut down. And then there came the guy that you had to put out of your misery. And all in one night, you know, it just sort of exciting, you know. And it was real funny, you know, when we got married, I thought that his drinking would stop because, you know, it's like you get married and everything changes. You know, he would come home and he would be, and he didn't. Those things, and he said, you sold me a bad bill of goods. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, for one thing, you never bitched about my drinking. You never had a headache. He said, now all this stuff. And I said, well, when you get that piece of paper, it makes things different, you know, but you don't tell them until after you get the paper. But it's like, okay, it's time to shape up. It's trying to be a real family here. It's trying to do those things. And that wasn't going to happen in our house because the disease of alcoholism was there for him, and the disease of alcoholism was there for me as well. Because the sick thinking and all the reacting and the things, now that we were on that downhill thing. And we didn't realize, I don't know about you, but have you had the relationship where it peaks out at the beginning and then goes downhill? I mean, that was how it was with us, you know. It was so good, and then here we go. And as the disease progressed, so did the insanity, so did the hard feelings. So there was violence, like I say. That violence that I had toward that boy across the street now happened to the boy there in the house. And, you know, his daddy nearly got him killed because his daddy would give him pep talks about coming home and getting the pants off of me and on himself. He said, "Jim, you're letting that woman control you over there. That's what it is." He said, "You'd do better if you would just go home, do what you need to do, get them pants off that woman, put them on," and then he'd go back hurt to his daddy. And then we played hide and seek. He'd go get drunk and hide, and I'd seek him. You know. Ain't a bird dog in the world compared to an Al-Anon on the horn. I tell you what. We were the best private investigators of the world. You can give us a clue, man, we can go. We develop a whole network, you know, and we can find you. Don't think you can't be found. We can find you. So the problem is when we find you, we don't want to find you the way we find you, because I would find him with her. He had these lower companions that he was just drawn to, you know, and they would be sitting at a table having a drink. Well, God, you can't let that happen. You walk in, you turn the table upside down, you slap her flat, you proceed to pulverize him, and the bouncer throws you out. And you're only there trying to save your home, for God's sake. Now, JD's never been thrown out, but I've been barred from 3 bars and 2 pawn shops. And then if the bouncer was a little ugly with me, then I'd go hand-to-hand with him, and I'd go to jail for assault. And that was, you know, that was how that would happen, you know. So finally I got to where I quit looking for him, you know. I just quit looking for him, and I just wait for the police to call me and tell me when they had him. And he'd beg them, "Don't call her. Don't call her. She'll hurt me. Don't call her." And I'd go get him, and I'd bring him home and kill him. And and then we did that one day at a time. Well, sooner or later, you know, we had to do something different. And I told him, I said, "I can't live like this. You're going to have to do something. You're going to have to get out. So it's going to matter." And he said, "I don't mean to do this." He said, "I don't mean to go out and get drunk. He said, "I just want to go out and get feeling good. That's all I want." But you see, his ability to get there and feel good had long gone away. And I didn't know that, because it looks like to us that you are having that good time and you're doing that deal, and you have a tendency to want to blame us. That's what I noticed, because I'd say, "Why do you do this?" He says, "Because you didn't do this." And then the next time it's because you did do this. Now it's the same damn thing. So it's like, you know, your mind, you know, you begin to get a little weird. You get a little quick, you know, just get a little quick. I'm beginning to have health problems. You know, I've got a high blood pressure, probably get a little kick, you know, every once in a while, you know. But if everything's fine at our house, and the doctor says, "Are you under any undue stress?" He said, "How about at work?" I said, "No, everything's fine." He said, "Oh, fine, fine, fine. There's nothing wrong with my home." You know, it's okay, you know. They're trying to take care of you, but, you know, we lie. We lie. We don't tell the truth what's going on, because we're ashamed. We're ashamed to tell what's going on in our home. And it wasn't just that I was ashamed to say my husband's a drunk, but I was ashamed to say, "Hey, I'm an abuser. I don't want to have to deal with that either." And there's something that happens to you on the inside when you hurt other people. It makes you very, very small, and there's a tremendous amount of self-loathing that comes with that. Tremendous amount. You can't hurt another one of God's kids without hurting yourself. It's just that simple. So anyway, I took him to the doctor, and the doctor told him, he said, you've got a drinking problem, J.D.? He said, "Yeah, a slight problem." "A slight problem. The Titanic had a little bad afternoon." Okay. And he said, "Well, you and I could go to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "They seem to be able to help people that have drinking problems." And J.D. said, "But I'm not an alcoholic." And I looked at him and I said, that's right, he's not an alcoholic. You know, he wasn't like my mother's people. He did not drink like they did. He didn't do like they did. So therefore, you know, it's funny, all my life I put people in boxes. I had this little box and this is where you went and these people went in this box over here, and you defined what they were and you judged them and you put them in the box. Well, you can't take them out of the box once you've got them boxed, because that means you made a mistake when you put them in the box. And you can't afford to be wrong, for God's sake, because you feel so wrong that one more wrong is more than you can bear. So you can't move people. Once you get them boxed, they're boxed. And they were the alcoholics over here, and he was my husband over there, and I couldn't put him in the alcoholic box. And I didn't want to either, because that was hopeless and helpless. I knew where that was over there. I had watched my mother try to deal with it an entire lifetime. So it couldn't be that way. But he asked for the doctor for a prescription. And he said that he had some friends that were taking Antabuse. And if the doctor would give him some Antabuse, he knew he could be okay. Just need a little help. So now the doctor hands us the prescription. I take the prescription because I can't trust him to do anything. And I become the keeper of the pills. Now, I've got high blood pressure. I've got an epileptic dog. Now JD's on the pills. Every morning in a hurry going to work, I can't guarantee who got what, but I can guarantee one thing, everybody got a pill. And now, you see, my dream has come true. You know, if he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. And see, he's not drinking. I'm not okay. Now, that's a real puzzler. And so I look at him again and I said, it's just like the other one. It's not his drinking. It's him. It's him. It's him that's the problem. So I decide, you know, all right, now, what do we need to do about him? Well, now, you see, this is the summer that the committee came in. And the committee, we had a meeting one night, and we're sitting there and we're talking, and it's like, well, you know, you could divorce him like you did your first one. Well, yeah, but, you know, if you have to keep divorcing him, you seem to be the common denominator. We really don't want to look there too far. Well, but what, all right, then, well, what if he were to die? What was that? Well, if he were to die, then you could be a widow. Sounds much better than a divorcee, and you get the insurance. You're right. Because, see, I worked for an insurance company, and I had him insured up to $1 million. And I got to the point where the underwriters wouldn't write him more insurance. They were afraid for him. Because every time he'd go out and get drunk, I'd get pissed off and get another policy. Because I knew he was going to die. Well, anyway, so I'm sitting there thinking, you know, he's worth more dead than alive. And that's true. And they said, but, you know, he's not really... He's not dying. That's no big deal. We can take care of that. Well, what do you suggest? Well, personally, I like stab him in the neck with an ice pick and watch him drip. Oh, best thought I'd had in a long time. And what about that? Well, why don't we just get tires and just roll over him with the back of the car and squish him up in the tread? That's right. Make a note. Buy new tires. And that's the way my thinking was going. And let me tell you something about that kind of thinking. Now, we all know we can do that kind of thinking. But, you know, when here we're the lucky ones, because, you see, we tell God, ourselves, and another person what we're thinking, you know. And I wasn't doing that. I wasn't living by any kind of spiritual principles. And if I had heard myself say it out loud, I might have said, God, that's crazy. But I didn't, because what you hear in your head makes sense to you. That's the scary part. It makes sense to you. But when you take it outside and look at it and let another person hear it, it makes a world of difference. It just makes a world of difference. But I didn't have that, so it made sense to me. And so I went on, and there was a lady in the paper that had killed her husband, said that he was an alcoholic, and they put her in prison. And I thought, tacky, tacky, tacky. If I'd have been on that jury, that wouldn't have happened. I can guarantee you that. And so it went on. We had to have another committee meeting now. You know, and it's like, well, what do you think we ought to do now? And so one night we came up with the idea, if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? It was a group conscience. We all liked it. So all you have to do now, once you make a decision, all you have to do is just wait for the right time to implement. You know, you get a certain amount of peace once you've made a decision. So the following January, We had ice and snow in Little Rock, which, as y'all know, is not normal for us. People don't know how to drive on it. And I came home from work that day, and it was pretty slick out. And later on that afternoon, I heard our truck at a high rate of pitch, you know, going, roar, and I'm thinking, God. And I look out just in time to see him come catty-corner across, and he hit the cast iron hitching post horse at the end of the driveway. He went shooting across the side of the yard. He hit a tree, and then he bounced into the side of the house. And I thought, he really can't drive on this. He really can't. And then he opened up that door, but he poured out of the truck. And I had seen that too many times. And I looked out that picture window, and I said, I'll kill that Ethel Lee if it's the last thing I ever do. And so when he came in, I never said anything. I just hit him as hard as I could. And when he fell, he hit our coffee table, and it knocked him out. And I drug him across the living room, in the hall, into the bathroom, took his clothes off of him, ran the bathtub full of warm water, and I put him in, and I held him under until the bubbles quit coming, because he was the problem, and I couldn't stand it any longer. And he's laying there in the bottom of the tub, and there's a voice that comes. It's not a committee member, and the voice says, look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I picked him up by the hair of the head, and I said, the hell I can't, and I put him back down again. And then the voice came back, and it said, don't you realize you're committing murder? You're taking the life of someone you once loved. Now, that's what he talks about in the book, about a moment of clarity, and what you see yourself is what you become. And I had become an animal to fight an illness, and it scared me to death. And I jerked him out of that bathtub. And thank God I had worked for the Red Cross, and I resuscitated him. And I drug him into the bedroom and put him in bed and got the hair dryer down and dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. And I had a problem with step two. Okay, it was different. You know how we always say, this time it's going to be different and nothing's any different? Well, this time it was different. And I left him in that room and I shut the door and I went in and I rocked in my chair for the next 8 to 10 hours with a desperation I have never known since. And it was that desperation that I don't know how. I know one thing, I can't live like this anymore. But I don't know how not to live like this anymore. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. It's just absolutely miserable. You need something?
Only you can perform this. These are alcoholic trucks and being...
Oh, my God!
And there are tow trucks there.
Oh, if you're parked in the fire lane... It's almost too late that they're there. This is your final warning. The tow trucks are out there right now, ready to do it. There's a red BMW, and a white GMC that are going bye-bye. Okay. Anyway, like I say, I was desperate, and so I didn't go back in that room. I wouldn't go back in that room. And there was 3 days that I heard him scream and I heard him ask for help and what have you. And you know, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I knew what it was to live with a drunk. But I didn't know a thing about alcoholism. And J.D. had drank too much in a short period of time and his body did not pass out. And he had gone into alcoholic poisoning, you know. And he would have been probably out of here without my help, you know. I mean, there it was. But he's in there and he's hemorrhaging and he's in there and he's in trouble. But I just think it's the normal. I'd heard him hallucinate. I'd heard him beg for help. I'd heard that many times. It didn't mean anything to me. And J.D. nearly died in that room. And one day I came home from work, and J.D. was sitting at our bar, and he was shaking so hard. And he said, would you call that number, Alcoholics Anonymous, for me? Because he said, I think I'm going to die if I don't get some help. And I said, what could a group of drunks do for you that I haven't done? He said, I don't know, but I do know I'm going to die. And he said, I've been trying to dial that number all day, and with our push-button phone, I keep getting the wrong numbers. He said, I can't seem, I'm shaking too hard. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a wonderful woman there that worked in central office. Her name was Mary Peeler. Some of you, the old-timers, will know Mary. And Mary answered, and she took that 12-step call. And she told me, she said, there is a meeting within 1 hour's time, just 6 blocks away from where you live. And I said, you mean where the Girl Scout meetings in the little community building down there, the Home Demonstration Club? And she said, yeah. I said, I'll be damned. My grandfather built that. The grandfather that died of alcoholism built that building. And I took him down there, and his miracle began. The miracle began. But, what's so funny about it, I was in such good shape, they whisked me off into the AA section and pushed him over with the Al-Anon because I looked so much worse than he did. You know? I was wearing checkerboard sunglasses 8 o'clock at night, you know? I was hiding out, you know? They thought she's bound to be a druggie, too, you know? And anyway, we got to straighten around, but they let me sit in on that meeting. They opened that meeting that night. And J.D. got to meet a guy who had come over and said, I'll be your sponsor. He just came over and says, I'll be your sponsor, his very first meeting. And then J.D., and I looked at him, and I wasn't impressed because this guy looked worse than Grandpa did when we buried him. But J.D. began to get better, and there's nothing worse than somebody getting better in the home, and it's not you. You know, you either grow together in this deal or you'll grow apart. It's really pretty simple. You know, if you're in there and the other one isn't in there, it's gonna be a little more difficult. You know, it's going to be a little more difficult. But anyway, later on, I would find it necessary for me to have to make that deal. And every time he'd come in from meetings, he'd bring me little pieces of literature and little brochures and stuff that the Al-Anon girls had sent to my house. I thought, why do they bother with this garbage? And I'd throw it in the desk. I don't know why I didn't throw it in the trash, but I just threw it in the desk. And then there came that night when he didn't come home from the meeting, and I was sure he and the old reprobate were both drunk. And she had a card in there. Says, my name's Arlene. If you ever want to talk, call me. It's 11:30 at night, Arlene. I want to talk. And so she didn't say a word about me waking her up. She was just very nice, and she invited me to come to the meeting. But I talked with her, so therefore I was okay, and I didn't need to go. You know, she did that for me. But a couple of weeks later, J.D. was going to lose his job, and now things were going to be terrible because, you know, he worked maybe one or two days on the job when he was drinking. And then that year that he'd been on the interviews, he worked all the time. And so I had gotten used to having a little more help financially. And now with him without a job, I knew the total responsibility was on me, and it became too much. And so I went to that Al-Anon meeting, and I told him I was there because of A, how do you manage when there's nothing left to manage, and B, how do you keep an alcoholic sober? And there was a smart aleck there, and her name was Harriet. And Harriet said, C, we don't know. And I know today what she was talking about, you know. But what she did, she and this other lady were visiting my group. My home group had two members. And there was these other two ladies that had come from 120 and a half group, and they were over there. And they began to share what only we can do. They know we understand. And they begin to tell you. And it's like they've been looking in the windows of my home. And I got something there that night that kept me coming back. And for a long time I wondered why I kept coming back in those first, say, 4, 5, 6 months. And today I can tell you the reason I came back was because of unconditional love. I was not a lovable person. I was hostile. I was so full of rage and fear and everything else. But for that 1 hour, I could feel comfort. I felt that love from those people because they cared about what happened to me. And so that unconditional love is what's kept me coming back, you know. And it doesn't make any difference why you keep coming back or why you come. It's why you stay. It's why you stay. And if you don't work the steps and do the deal, you won't stay. People who don't grow, go. It's that simple. You know, we try really hard sometimes to carry a person instead of a message. And we try to spend all this time on this one because we think, God, we really want them to get it. I really want them to get it. And the thing is, I can't get it enough for them. They have to do their own deal. And sometimes that just doesn't happen. I came in, I got a sponsor, I got involved in service right off the bat. I was tricked into that. I went to ride with my sponsor to a district meeting, and the secretary didn't show up, and I left secretary of the district. I don't know how that happened. You know, I'd never been to a meeting before, but now all of a sudden there you are, and I have a reason to be. So I went back and told the other two ladies, you know, we need a GR and an alternate and a secretary and treasurer, and they said, well, you can be the alternate, and you can take Ms. Ada. She'll be the GR because she can't drive. And the other girl said, I'll be secretary treasurer. So that was it. You know, we had our thing going. And today we have a huge group, and we meet 5 times a week. And it's all together different. altogether different. The program's still the same. But, I mean, there's just so much more. You know, it's more fashionable now to be in the program than it was way back then, you know. Because back then, when I first came in, the only people in Al-Anon were the sober spouses, or the spouses of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't have anybody coming that had somebody still out there drinking. You know, that's a lot different now. In fact, in my home group, most of them don't have someone in the program. So it makes a lot of difference. Well, as we begin to get better, you know, we had a lot of struggles to go through, and but we have a pretty decent relationship because we started working the traditions in our home, and we started doing those things and talking with other couples and having couples meetings and worrying out how to do this, how to practice this program at home, because you know, at home it's so easy to start a new relationship, dump the one you got, get you another one, because you don't have anything to have to start, you know, behind the eight ball. But I can tell you something. I have dumped a husband and I have kept a husband. And it's much easier to stay in and go. You feel better about yourself and you'll actually learn something if you stay in there and try to do the deal at home. Keep what you got. You know, a lot of us, we find out, are married right when we get here. You know, and yes, there's damage and it takes a while for healing to take place. But stay in and go for the deal. You know, that's what it's all about, loving one another and staying together and trying to work it out. The worst relationship, as you know, was with my mom, and that was one of the hardest ones to deal with because I hated my mom. I hated her all my life. And the main reason she didn't love me, you know, it's real easy to love people who love you, but it's a little harder when you're doing it the other way, and I never felt love for my mom. I never felt that kind of love. And so anyway, I was talking to my sponsor about it, and she says, well, if you're ready, God will provide you a teacher. And sure enough, he did. A girl from Missouri came down. And she had worked through a lot of mama problems, and she began to give me some tools. And the first tool she said was, accept your own limitations where your mother's concerned, and that will help you to accept hers where you're concerned. She says, it always starts with us. It's, we've got to do the deal. And I said, why do I always have to do the deal? When is she going to have to do something? She said, she doesn't ever have to do anything any different. It's what you do that makes a difference for you. You know, this is a program of action, not of other people's action, but of ours. And see, as an Al-Anon, I'm not so much an actor as I am a reactor, you know. And so I had to learn to start taking action instead of doing the reaction all the time. And I found out that children react, adults act. You know, that's the thing. It was my own immaturity, what I wanted. And one day, she gave me another tool, and she said, ask God to let you see your mama like he sees her. And I thought, well, what does that mean? And she says, well, God created her, and he knows every day of her life. He's the only person that knows your mama inside out. And maybe he'll give you a glimpse of what your mama's about to help you. And but I went ahead and I began to take actions I didn't want to take. You know, it was really difficult. It's getting close to that time, Mother's Day. You know, you want to find a generic card that says, Happy Mother's Day, bitch. You know. And you don't, well, now that we have computers, you know, we can do those. But God didn't give me a computer until that was over. But anyway. The deal on that was I would go ahead and I would say, I'd send those little shoebox cards, you know, the little sarcastic ones. And my mama hated those. She wanted one of those sweet cards. And I said, I just can't do that. I can't do that. I can't send one of those sweet cards. It just goes against everything. And they said, but if that's what your mother would want, if you're going to be a kind of daughter, a kind and loving daughter, you would give your mother what she wants. And so I'd get the card, and I'd look at it and go, I can't do this, I can't do this. And then I would scribble Mary Pearl on it real quick and close it up. And then I carried the first one to my sponsor, and I said, I don't know if I can do this. And she said, I can mail it, and just there it was. You know? And so the next card wasn't so hard to do and those kind of things, and I got to where I was doing it, and I'm real glad I did. Because you see, when my mother was going to pass away, and when I went and was going through her stuff, she had kept every one of those sentimental cards. That meant something to her because, see, my mother felt that she was not the kind of mother that she needed to be. And when she'd get that card, it said, yeah, you're doing okay. You know, it was giving her positive reinforcement. You know, that's all it was. I went on and I did those things. And then one night I realized that Daddy wasn't a saint and he wasn't perfect and that he had done a lot of things. He was sort of passive-aggressive. And I saw that and I thought, you know, I compared mother against the saint forever. No wonder she came up on the short end of the stick. And so then finally I said, well, okay, do something different here. And I don't know how to tell her. I tried to make amends to her many times. It always falls flat. We couldn't be in the same room together 5 minutes. We weren't arguing back and forth with one another. So it was just, it was unbelievable. And so anyway, I went ahead and I did the deal. Do we have another problem?
Somebody's blocking them and they're in an emergency. They need to leave now. The car blocked.
Okay, there's some people who have an emergency. They need to leave, and there's a Caprice Classic that's green, Chevrolet, license plate 579BTC. They need you to move because they need to get out. It's an emergency.
Arkansas.
It's an Arkansas plate. Uh-huh. Okay, where were we? Okay. I had prayed that prayer many, many times for God to let me see Mother, and then one fall afternoon I went over to my mother's, and there it was. I could see my mom. And she was standing at the back, and she was raking leaves, and I realized she was way back in that back field, but I said, Mama's short. Now, that may sound stupid to you, but Mama looked real short to me, and I said, Mama comes up to about here. Why did I think Mama was so tall? And it occurred to me that I had always come over as that little child looking up to Mama, coming for approval. I had never come to her as one adult to another adult. I always came as that needy child, needing her approval, because approval would have meant the same thing as love to me. And so I was just amazed, and as I began to walk back there, it was like I could see her heart, and her heart had scars all over it. Now, I always felt like my mother held love from me as a punishment. She refused to show me love to punish me. And I realized that Mama didn't have a lot of love in there. There wasn't anything. And it's like, you know, you can't give what you don't have. And that's when it hit me. You were taught how to love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. If anybody needs to give love in this situation, you need to give love to your mom. Accept her as she is and love her just as she is. And I didn't really want to do that. But I knew it was the right thing to do. And, you know, we suit up, show up, and do the next right thing. That's what we're taught to do. And so I went back there, and I put my arms around my mother, and I gave my mother a hug. And, boy, she stiffened up. She just didn't want any part of that hug, because we don't laugh, and we don't love, and we don't touch, and we don't do any of those things. And instead, I hugged her. And I'm glad I did. And every time I'd go over there, I would hug her because it made me feel good on the inside. You know, what you're doing, you get the benefit from. And then it got to the point where my mother, you know, she would look forward to it. She wouldn't rush over and hug you, but she would sort of waiting there for us, you know. And then my mother, there came the afternoon that my mother called. Or rather, I had been to the bank that day, it's just like I heard the voice that said, go by your mom's today. And when I went by my mother's that day, she wanted to talk about things that happened when my daddy died. And in that, talking about that, she said, you know, I always wondered why you were such an ornery kid. And I said, I was getting even with you for not loving me. And my mama said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I gave you a roof over your head. I gave you clothes to wear. I gave you food to eat. It was more than I ever had. And you see, my mother came from that alcoholic home where her mother and father both drank. And her father had physically abused her many, many times. She had scars all over her body when he'd come in drunk and cut her up with a knife and stuff. And when she was 13, he'd come in and tried to rape her that night. And she picked up a stick of stove wood and hit him in the head. And she never went back home again. She ran away from home, and she lived on the street. Now, in the early 1900s, that wasn't very fashionable, you know. And she ended up in Memphis, and she was living in an alleyway in Memphis. And the lady who owned the boarding house next to that alleyway saw my mama out there and felt sorry for her and told her that if she would come in and help her, the lady was pregnant. She said, if you'll help me with cleaning and waiting on tables and stuff, I'll give you room and board. And so my daddy was the head of the recruiting office in Memphis, Tennessee, and he took his meals at that boarding house. And that's how they met. And they got married, and she was 16, he was 28, you know. And so if you had to live like that, what was the greatest gift you could ever give your child? Not to have to worry about food to eat and clothes to wear, you know. She gave the best she had, and that day it became enough. That hole inside me closed up, and my mother leaned over, and she put her arms around me, and she gave me a big hug, and she said, you know, baby, I love you. I've always loved you, And I knew she had, to the best of her ability. That was it. And it was enough. You know, we were okay. And we had many good years together, and then Mother got a mental illness. And the thing about mental illness, I'm so glad, you know, alcohol is a wonderful disease to have if you have it, because it's going to teach you how to deal with a lot of other disease. Disease don't make sense, y'all. It really doesn't, especially mental illness. And so alcoholism doesn't make sense either when you think about it. And so, you know, I found that I was dealing with my mother's disease once I accepted the fact that she had the mental disease so much better than my sister was able to. Because, you know, you don't try to make sense. You know, when Mama would say things, you don't argue with him. You just let go. It's like trying to argue with a drunk who's drinking. What's the point? He's not there. You know. You know, and here was my mother. She wasn't there either. And she began to miss things, and she began to accuse me of stealing things, and J.D. of stealing things. And then she began to accuse us of trying to murder her, which had been a thought upon occasion. But in actuality, we weren't, you know. And it was real disturbing, and that disease was progressive also. And finally, my mother had a major stroke. And when she had the major stroke, she knew my sister had the power of attorney instead of myself, because she'd written me out of everything, because I'm the thief. And my sister put her in the nursing home. So she got mad, slapped my sister, and I became the good kid. And I went to see my mom. I'd walk every morning, and I'd go down to the nursing home, and I'd see my mom every day. And I have some really good memories of that time. And then my mother had more strokes, as stroke people are prone to do. And she became a vegetable. And that was a real, real hard thing to see for a long time. And but I was able to, on the Christmas Eve of 1990, I was able to take my portable keyboard. That mother who didn't love me, who gave me 12 years of music, wanted me to be a concert pianist, but she wanted it too much, therefore I couldn't do it. You know, I had to rebel. And if she hadn't wanted, I just couldn't, you know, anyway. So, anyway, I went down there and I set up my keyboard and I start playing for them. And the people there in the nursing home, the patients, they love music. And my mother, at this point, the only way she could communicate was with a tear. That's the only way she could communicate at all. And I looked and she was keeping time to the music with her hand, and the tears were flowing. So I knew my mom knew I was there, and that was my gift, you know. My mom never knew anything else, and she died on the 1st of February. And I was surrounded by a conference that we decided a year in advance. You know how God goes ahead and plans in love? We had decided a year before that we would have this conference on the first weekend in February. And so I was surrounded by my home group when my mother died. You know, God was really good. He was really good providing all that there. And the people of the program, they walk through you with anything and everything. You know, there's nothing that you can't have help with here. Now, you would think that after all of this, I would be a person who is, after all the years of the program I've had, you know, I shouldn't have any problems with stuff. But I tell you, life keeps happening. Life keeps happening. And to show you, you know, I still have a problem with accepting things. And here a few years ago, I decided I'd have this wonderful, wonderful front yard. And J.D. had had the water garden incident, which I told you all about last time. Well, then I decided I wanted the front yard fixed up. And so I did this massive flower bed and free form. And I went to the quarry and got all these rocks. Spent an entire day picking out rocks, you know, one at a time, lining them up in this little scallop so you have just enough, not one rock too many, not one rock, but I'm not a perfectionist, but got these little New Mexico whitewashed river rock, and I brought them home, and I put all these hostas across the front, and I put all these elephant ears up against the back, and in the middle I wanted impatiens because they're so pretty, and I had every color, 17 flats. That's a lot of impatience. That's a lot of little holes and stuff, you know. And then, you know, the commercials we see on TV, I saw one yesterday for Miracle-Gro, you know. I use Miracle-Gro, got a 50-pound tomato. Yes, yes. Now, the instructions on Miracle-Gro said use once a month, so I used it every week, you know. If once, y'all understand that. I don't have to explain to one of y'all about that. And so I'm in there, and I've got, you know, 4-foot-tall impatiens out in the front yard. And people are stopping taking pictures. God, have you ever seen impatiens like that? No. And then one afternoon I come in, there's a giant hole in the middle of the impatiens. I'm going, what the hell happened there? Because, see, now, perfection is ruined. There's no way to start new impatiens and have them be the same size. I mean, you know, these others have got 6 weeks on them, you know. It's just ruined. And there's, the patients are very tender little plants, and if you just knock them over, you just snap them off. And so there I was, and I was just beside myself, and then J.D. came in, and he says, I found what the problem is. It's a calico cat. Somebody, somewhere in our neighborhood or whatever, this cat decided to use my impatience as its stalking jungle. And we have a bird feeder, and we got all sorts of squirrels out there in the yard. And so it's a feeding ground. You know, he comes lurching out of the impatience, and he eats the birds and the squirrels. Well, I just went berserk, and I went on a quest to kill the cat, to get rid of the cat. Now, I have never liked cats. I got attacked by my sister's cat when I was small. I had 16 stitches. Never liked cats. I'm a dog person. So I don't like this cat in particular. So I begin to do things, and I begin to ask people. Now, people are wonderful. They give you suggestions. One said mothballs. So I got 4 boxes of mothballs. You could smell our house from blocks away. Cat does not bother. It doesn't bother the cat. And then somebody said crack cayenne pepper. So I went to Sam's, got the big half gallons, and did the yards, you know. Doesn't bother the cat. Must be a Southwest cat. What can I tell you? So then, you know, I mean, I'm doing this over a period of time, and then there was, I thought, okay, and a friend of ours in the program has a little pump-up gun, and I said, okay, I'll borrow you the little pump gun, and so I'm out there shooting the little pellets at the cat. And so I pumped it up 3 times, I see the cat, I beat him, whack, and he goes, "Ew!" like that, and then he comes back. So I pump it up to 6, and I give him a whoo. And he gets it again, and he comes back. It's obvious it's an alley cat. He keeps doing the same thing, expecting something different. I pump it up to 10. I beat in on him, and I shoot the gun. He jumps off the fence just in the nick of time, and I knock a hole in the next door neighbor's house. Not good. Not good. So I decided maybe I shouldn't do that, so I put the gun down for a while. And I went through, and I had a friend up in Oregon the next year, and I planted impatience the next year expecting it to be different. You know, me and the cat, you know, neither one of us are changing here, so we're doing the same thing the second year, you know. And I have this friend in Oregon, she says, plastic forks. She says, these little picky plastic forks. She said, you put them in the handle first, and the cat can't walk on them. I can't either. You got to be able to weed that stuff, you know? So I'm telling my sponsor, she just laughs. She just laughs. She says, you're going to figure it out. And I'm going, wonder, what is she talking about? You're going to figure it out. And so finally when I'm in there and I'm praying, I'm saying, God, I really hate this cat, you know. And then it became very obvious, you know, accept the things you cannot change. You're not going to change the nature of a cat to not go and eat birds and eat squirrels. You're not going to change the nature of the cat, so accept the cat. So, okay. Except the cat. I go out, I told J.D. so he couldn't believe this, but I walk outside and I said, I had named the cat by this time, and so I said, welcome to my yard, F.C. You can be my yard cat. Live here, frolic, eat squirrels, eat birds, do whatever you want. It's your yard. You'll be the outside cat. I came back in the house. I said, I think I'm going to puke. But I took the action. I took the action. Next morning I get up and I'm doing my reading and my meditation. You got to remember now, I'm a late riser, so it's around 11, 1130. And I've done all my readings and everything. I'm looking out the window and one of my happy squirrels is chewing a limb off of my Japanese maple bonsai. And I'm going, no! And I went running out the front door and I went tearing down the steps screaming, get away from my face, get away from my face. Where the hell's my cat? Where is the cat? Eat that squirrel. Where is my cat? I've never seen the cat again. All you have to do is accept it and it goes away. Now to show you how sick I am, wonder what happened to the cat. I drove up and down the streets of town. I'm looking for my cat. God forbid my cat should be smushed on the road. Is that crazy or what, you know? But see, one more time, God has a sense of humor. All you have to do is accept the cat, and the cat went away. Never seen him to this day. I have not seen him. That's been 2 years. I've been looking for my cat, you know. But guess what? The next year, I didn't plant impatience. You know, I learned something different. You know, I learned that I was the one that was doing the same thing. The cat was doing the nature of the cat. I was the one that was out of sync. And that seems to be the way it always works, is when I'm not doing what I need to be doing. And I get real frustrated, because that's when I'm trying to force someone, something, some situation to be other than the way it's supposed to be, instead of accepting and changing me. That's the only thing I have any power over, is changing myself. Last year was a really hard year for us. JD and I both had a lot of physical problems, and some very, very painful physical problems. But this year it seems to be, I've been feeling a lot better physically. JD and I have had the opportunity to go on a sober sailor cruise here a few weeks ago, and we sailed the Caribbean for a week. And JD was sitting there, and I said, he was going on and on, and I said, just think, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be on this cruise. And he says, and if it wasn't for me, you would never got to Al-Anon. You wouldn't be on this cruise either. You know, the thing about it is, it gets better and better, and the sky's the limit, you know. The bottom line is, you can get as much or as little out of this program as you put into it. The more you put into it, you know, if you learn to live it one day at a time, practicing the steps and the principles that are in this program, there is nothing. There is nothing. Because, you see, there was no way to come from where I was to where it is today. There was no way to do that, you know. That's the reason I'm really glad to be here and to be able to share with y'all, because I do feel like that my life has changed. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top, while I the underside. Not till the loom is solid and the shuttle cease to fly, will God unroll that canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in the skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you.